You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast, and this is part 5 of a series in the books of 1st and 2nd Kings. 1st Kings, chapter 4, verse 1. King Solomon was king over all Israel, and these were his high officials. Azariah, the son of Zadok, was the priest. Elihoreph and Ahijah, the sons of Shisha, were secretaries. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was in command of the army. Zadok and Abiathar were priests. Azariah, the son of Nathan, was over the officers. Zabud, the son of Nathan, was priest and king's friend. Ahishar was in charge of the palace. And Adoniram, the son of Abda, was in charge of the forced labour. Solomon had 12 officers over all Israel who provided food for the king and his household. Each man had to make a provision for 1 month in the year. These were their names: Ben-Hur in the hill country of Ephraim, Ben-Decher in Machaz Shalbim, Beth-Shemesh and Elon-Beth-Hanan, Ben-Hesed in Araboth, to him belonged Soko and all the land of Hefer, Ben-Abinadab in all Naphath Dor, he had Taphath, the daughter of Solomon, as his wife, Bana, the son of Ahilud, in Tanakh, Megiddo, and all Beth Shean, that is beside Zarathan, below Jezreel, and from Beth Shean to Abel Mehalah, as far as the other side of Jokmeam. Ben Geber, in Ramoth Gilead, he had the villages of Jair, the son of Manasseh, which are in Gilead, and he had the region of Argob, which is in Bashan, 60 great cities with walls and bronze bars. Ahinadab, the son of Iddo, in Mahanaim. Ahimaaz, in Naphtali, he had taken Basemath, the daughter of Solomon, as his wife. Bana, the son of Hushai, in Asher and Baaloth. Jehoshaphat, the son of Peruah, in Issachar. Shimei, the son of Elah, in Benjamin. Geber, the son of Uri, in the land of Gilead, the country of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and of Og, king of Bashan. And there was one governor who was over the land. And we'll pause there after reading to verse 19. This section carries on, of course, what we've seen in the previous episode, where Solomon asked for wisdom to administer justice. And we saw that worked out in an individual case of the two prostitutes in the second half of chapter 3. But here we're seeing how Solomon brought administration to the whole land of Israel. We see the names of the officials that he appointed. And there is a distinction between different levels of administration. So the first four names seem to be set apart: Azariah the priest, or high priest as they would later be called, Elihoreph and Ahijah, who are secretaries, their role to record the laws and disseminate them and record what was brought into the court, and Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder, and these are the top officials, it would seem. And then we have a number of others: Benaiah, whose responsibility is with the army, Zadok and Abiathar, both of whom would have been very old by this stage. And of course, Abiathar was put into exile in Anathoth, as we saw in chapter 2. Whether he was removed from office or kind of kept titular sense in office, allowed to retain that designation, although he was removed from the centre of power and from Jerusalem, we don't know. Again, these names are the officials at a certain point in Solomon's reign, not throughout his whole 40-year reign. Azariah is over the officers, and those officers are going to be named from verse 7 onwards. Those are regional officials, and Azariah oversees them. Zabud, again a priest and king's friend, and Ahishar in charge of the palace, and Adoniram in charge of forced labour. And that mention of forced labour is significant for reasons that we'll come to in a moment. Then from verses 7 onwards, we have the names of 12 officials, 12 officers who are over all Israel, who provide food for the king and his household. And this, of course, is part of the reality of kingship, that the kingly court has to be provided for through a system of taxation. And the way that Solomon arranged that was to divide the land into 12 districts or regions. And those regions are identified throughout this passage. Each of them took a turn 1 month in the year to bring the provisions. Now, of course, when we read the number 12, we might automatically think that this is representative of the 12 tribes of Israel. But the districts that are defined here are not defined on the basis of the tribes, but of months. And the suggestion may be that Solomon is breaking up some of the old tribal loyalties. He's uniting what had been a tribal confederation, certainly prior to the time of the kings. In Judges, you get this sense of judges who ruled over one or a few tribes but didn't necessarily unite the whole nation, and you see battles and tensions between the tribes. But this is maybe a skillful move to unite the nation into a single central administration. But there's another very interesting feature here, that as we read down the list of places that are named in verses 7 to 19, there is no place name that is definitely in the region of Judah. Some reckon that some of the names may be in Judah, but that's a bit speculative. There are none that are certainly in Judah. And so the suggestion seems to be that Solomon is treating Israel separately from Judah. Now, again, if you're familiar with the history, you'll know that after the reign of Solomon, the northern tribes, 10 tribes, separated off and became the kingdom of Israel. The southern tribes of Judah and Benjamin stayed together under the dynasty of David. But that division between north and south was already present even in the time of Saul. Whenever David became king, he was king for 7 years over Judah before all Israel embraced him. And in fact, the tensions between Judah and the other tribes, certainly especially the tribes descended from Joseph, Ephraim being the biggest of those, Manasseh being the other one, both of which are northern tribes, that goes right back to the book of Genesis, to the narratives about Joseph's brothers. Joseph, of course, rises to prominence in Egypt, but Judah is the not the firstborn, but he's the eldest son who is not disqualified from the inheritance, as his older brothers are because of different things that they did. But Judah is not disqualified, and it's Judah that his father identifies as the one from whom kings will come. The scepter will not depart from Judah when Jacob blesses his 12 sons. So there's a tension between Judah and Joseph in Genesis. There's this division even in the time of David. And as we've seen already in 1 Kings, the author of 1 Kings refers to David as king over Israel and Judah, of course, knowing the division that was going to come later. Now, it may be that Solomon's administration here is part of what created and fermented the division that would become concrete after his death. Again, some interpreters, some scholars suggest that at the very end of verse 19, when it says there was one governor who was over the land, and it uses a different word there, the ESV that I've read from puts it as governor as opposed to officer that is used in verse 7, that governor may have been a governor of Judah, that and certainly the later Greek translation of the Old Testament puts it that way, says there was one governor who was over Judah. But the oldest manuscripts in the Hebrew don't mention Judah there. And it seems more likely as we read this text that governor is probably referring to Azariah, the son of Nathan, who verse 5 says was over the officers, or maybe to Adoniram, who in verse 6 is said to be in charge of the forced labour. Now, that raises the question, how was Judah administered? Well, Judah seems to have been exempted from this tax, didn't have to provide for the king. Because remember, this administration is about taxing that will pay for the king's household. And if that is true, then you can see how over time that would have begun to bring resentment from the other tribes that Solomon is favouring his own tribe of Judah above them. The other thing that's interesting, and I mentioned this, said I would refer to this, is in verse 6 when it talks about Adoniram, who's in charge of forced labour. There are references earlier in the Bible to Israel using forced labour in the land. But that refers to people who are conquered by Israel. You read about that in Deuteronomy 20 verse 11, Joshua 16 verse 10 and Joshua 17 13. In other words, these were as a form, I suppose, of not quite slavery, but certainly indentured labour, people who didn't have a choice about the work that they were doing. It's a term that's used for the Israelites when they were in Egypt, Exodus 1:11. But what changes with Solomon is, as you'll see in chapter 5, verses 13 to 14, is that Solomon uses conscripted labourers from Israel. And that, of course, is again one of the things that will go wrong. There is an inevitable cost of a royal family and a royal court. As I've said, Samuel had warned about that back in 1 Samuel 8, 11 to 18. He warned that there would be a cost of having a king when the people were asking for a king. But if you read on in 1 Kings 4 to the very next verse, verse 20, it says, Judah and Israel, again, notice the distinction, were as many as the sand by the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Now, again, I mentioned in the last episode, which talked about the numerous, when Solomon said to God that the people were so numerous that they couldn't be counted, that this is a fulfillment of God's promises to Abraham back in the book of Genesis. The sand by the sea, but they ate and drank and were happy. In other words, this administrative system that Solomon set up initially was a great success because he brought stability and or at least it wasn't a burden to the people. So it was a success, I suppose, in providing for Solomon, but the people were happy to tolerate it because of the peace and prosperity that they were enjoying. But as we get further into reading about Solomon's reign, we'll see that this changes. We'll see that in chapters 9 to 11, the way that Solomon rules begins to be oppressive of his people. He begins to use the taxes that he gathers for his own personal comfort and glory. And that, of course, sows the seeds for why there was then a rebellion against Solomon by Jeroboam, and why after Solomon's death the northern tribes followed Jeroboam into rebellion against Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. So what are we to make of this passage? Well, there are signs of wisdom here, certainly, and ability to administer, the ability to delegate, to set up good structures. These are aspects of wisdom, aren't they? Structures that work to bring order and to support the people and bring justice and so on. All of that is good and proper and right. But there is also there are also indicators here that things are not well, that forced labour is going to be used in a destructive way. That this system of officials will be used not to bring peace and stability, but to oppress and to make the king excessively rich. And if we're right in saying that Judah is excluded from this, that there is an inequality that is not a mark of godly wisdom. So Solomon, yes, is using godly wisdom, but there are also flaws in how he does this. Let's read on then in 1 Kings chapter 4 from verse 20, which we've already read, but let's read it as part of the wider context. 1 Kings 4 verse 20, Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal. 10 fat oxen and 20 pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. For he had dominion over all the region west of the Euphrates, from Tipsha to Gath, over all the kings west of the Euphrates. And he had peace on all sides around him. And Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, all the days of Solomon. Solomon also had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen, and those officers supplied provisions for King Solomon and for all who came to King Solomon's table, each one in his month. They let nothing be lacking. Barley also and straw for the horses and swift steeds they brought to the place where it was required, each according to his duty. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure, and breadth of mind like the sand on the seashore, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the East, and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all other men, wiser than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, Calcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol. And his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He also spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees, from the cedar that is in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. He spoke also of beasts and of birds and of reptiles and of fish. And people of all nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. We'll pause there after verse 34, the end of chapter 4. And we're seeing here again, as I mentioned in relation to verse 20, the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham. God had told Abraham that he would make a great nation from him, and that that nation would be so numerous that they couldn't be counted like the sand on the seashore. Genesis 22 verse 17 and 32 verse 12. And not only that, he said he would give them the land, and that all nations of the earth would be blessed through them. And we're seeing that happening through Solomon here. They are secure in the land under God's rule through the king that God has appointed. They are enjoying the blessings of God's covenant. They are blessing the nations as well. The people of all nations come to hear Solomon's wisdom. The kings of the earth come. And we get a further insight here into what the nature of Solomon's wisdom is. It's understanding and discernment, but it's also a breadth of mind. That's quite an interesting picture, verse 29. It's not simply depth of understanding of a narrow subject, but a breadth of understanding of a range of subjects that enables Solomon to make connections between those. And the output of that is thousands of proverbs. Of course, we have many of those in the book of Proverbs. And songs as well. He's a composer of songs like his father David. But also knowledge about the natural world and understanding of the trees and the beasts and the fish. So there is a breadth to Solomon's learning that is here, and a blessing that comes through it to many of the surrounding nations. But we also have this insight into the life that Solomon lives. Now, on one level, of course, again, the blessing here is expanded beyond the reign of David. Solomon is securely reigning over a vast, really, empire, I suppose, in the area, beyond the boundaries of the tribes of Israel. So Judah and Israel live in safety from Dan, that's the most northerly point, to Beersheba, the most southerly point. Every man under his vine and fig tree, that's a symbol of bounty, isn't it, of the natural world and provision of food. Figs and vines are not the staple food of bread, they are the luxuries, if you like. So there is, people are really enjoying a degree of luxury. But Solomon also is able to subjugate the kings west of the Euphrates, right up to the Euphrates River, which is in modern day Iraq, and that means the regions of that we would call today Syria. and he is so he's ruling over this empire, and kings are bringing tribute to him, including the Philistines to the west and southwest. But if the people are living in a degree of prosperity, Solomon himself is living in great abundance. One day's provision for him and for his court was 30 cores. Now, I'm told by the footnotes in my Bible that a core is 220 litres. So do the maths. 30 cores is thousands of litres of fine flour, and double that of meal. And then all of the animals as well. So this is a hugely costly enterprise. And he has 40,000 stalls of horses, 12,000 horsemen. This is exactly what Samuel had warned about, that a king would be costly. And this really is the seed and the root of Solomon's downfall, this kind of indulgence and promotion of his own ends, spurred on, of course, by the wife that he had married, who we've met earlier, the daughter of Pharaoh, and who will come up again. Now, it's not yet oppressive at this point. It seems that the people are prosperous. Solomon is prosperous. The people are happy for him to have more than they have, because everything is going well for them. But the seeds are here again of the kind of oppression that is going to come later. And already Solomon is breaching the requirement of the law back in Deuteronomy 17, verse 16. The king, it says, was not to acquire great numbers of horses for himself, but Solomon has done that. He's modelling himself after the kind of king that his wife's father, the Pharaoh of Egypt, was. And this will lead to disaster in his later reign. And so there seems to be something of a contrast between how Solomon treated himself and the wisdom that he had in relation to the natural world that we've read about in verses 29 to 34. So the positive aspect, the wisdom that God has given, was insight into God's creation and God's nature, the working of a human heart and of human minds, the workings of trees and living creatures. In these things, Solomon had wisdom, but in his personal choices about his personal life and standard of living, well, there's no mention of God's wisdom in that passage whatsoever. And I think there's a deliberate contrast there. That Solomon, at one level, is wise, and at another level, in his personal life, is acting foolishly and disobediently to God. Let's read on then into chapter 5 of 1 Kings. 1 Kings 5, verse 1. Now Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants to Solomon when he heard that they had anointed him king in the place of his father, for Hiram always loved David. And Solomon sent word to Hiram, "You know that David, my father, could not build a house for the name of the Lord, because his God, because of the warfare with which his enemies surrounded him, until the Lord put them under the soles of his feet. But now the Lord my God has given me rest on every side. There is neither adversary nor misfortune. And so I intend to build a house for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord said to David my father, 'Your son, whom I will set on your throne in your place, shall build the house for my name.' Now, therefore, command that cedars of Lebanon be cut for me, and my servants will join your servants, and I will pay you for your servants such wages as you set, for you know that there is no one among us who knows how to cut timber like the Sidonians." As soon as Hiram heard the words of Solomon, he rejoiced greatly and said, "Blessed be the Lord this day, who has given to David a wise son to be over this great people." And Hiram sent to Solomon, saying, "I have heard the message that you have sent to me. I am ready to do all you desire in the matter of cedar and cypress timber. My servants shall bring it down to the sea from Lebanon, and I will make it into rafts to go by sea to the place you direct. And I will have them broken up there, and you shall receive it, and you shall meet my wishes by providing food for my household. So Hiram supplied Solomon with the timber of cedar and cypress that he desired, while Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 cores of wheat as food for his household and 20,000 cores of pressed oil. Solomon gave this to Hiram year by year, and the Lord gave Solomon wisdom as he promised him, and there was peace between Hiram and Solomon, and the two of them made a treaty. King Solomon drafted forced labour out of all Israel, and the draft numbered 30,000 men, and he sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 a month in shifts. They would be a month in Lebanon and 2 months at home. Adoniram was in charge of the draft. Solomon also had 70,000 burden bearers and 80,000 stone cutters in the hill country, besides Solomon's 3,300 chief officers who were over the work, who had charge of the people who carried on the work. At the king's command, they quarried out great costly stones in order to lay the foundation of the house with dressed stones. So Solomon's builders and Hiram's builders and the men of Gebel did the cutting and prepared the timber and the stone to build the house. We'll finish our reading there in verse 18, the end of chapter 5 of 1 Kings. Now we've moved on to a new subject here, and the commentators note that 40% of the account of Solomon's life, which is chapters 1 to 11 of 1 Kings, or certainly chapters 2 to 11, around 40% of that relates to the building and dedication of the temple. In fact, it's the central section of Solomon's life. The whole narrative of Solomon is divided into a kind of mirror image structure. You have chapters 1 and 2 that talk about how Solomon succeeded from his father David. And then you've God meeting with Solomon in chapter 3. And then how Solomon uses his wisdom. And then you have this big section from chapters 5 through to chapter 9, verse 9, which are all about the temple building, with a little bit in the middle of that about Solomon's own palace. And then we return to the idea of Solomon's wife, Pharaoh's daughter, and we see Solomon beginning to use his wisdom in wrong ways. Then God speaks to him again in chapter 11, and then God's opposition to Solomon at the end of chapter 11. So Solomon begins his reign relatively well, as we've seen so far. He ends his reign badly. But the central event, the central legacy, if you like, of Solomon is the building of this temple. And here in chapter 5, we see his preparations for the temple. Of course, Solomon is right that David had said that, or God had said to David in 2 Samuel 7, that David's son would build the temple, would build a house for the Lord. So Solomon is aware of that promise. He's aware that he has peace and is able to do this. And he makes an alliance with the neighbouring kingdom of Sidon under Hiram, a kingdom in modern-day Lebanon that has access to timber that Solomon doesn't have in the lands that he reigns directly. And so he sets up this commercial arrangement to get the timber that he'll need to build what will be a vast building complex in the temple. Now, of course, God had said that the temple ought to be built by David's son, but he gave no instructions as to what the temple should look like. That's different with the tabernacle. If you read in Exodus, you see that God was very specific in the instructions about what the tabernacle, the movable tent that preceded the temple, should be like. And that God provided the people filled with the Spirit of God, Exodus 31, 1 to 11 and 35 into 36 tell us. So God provided the people with the skills and the expertise and the pattern, but with the temple, he seems to allow Solomon to make those decisions. God doesn't give specific requirements, and Solomon decides to build a very, very grand building, not his only building. As we'll see, he builds his own palace, which is also very grand. But that means that he has to go outside Israel for the building materials and for the expertise, because there are no Israelites with the skill to cut the wood like the Sidonians. And certainly God gives skill to these people. These are gifts from him. But we might wonder whether Solomon is being wise here in the scale of the building, because it leads to enforced labour amongst the Israelites. I've mentioned that before, that this is a new thing in the reign of Solomon. Was Solomon right to enforce labourers from Israel, 10,000 at a time, to go up to Sidon? Would he not have been better to allow them to freely volunteer to build a smaller temple, to use simply the skills that God had made available amongst his people? Certainly the building of the temple seems to be a turning point where Solomon turns towards oppression of his people in the later years of his reign. So it could be that this is an example of someone doing God's work in their own way. Of course, we have to do God's work in God's way, don't we? It's not enough that we say here is the end that God desires, and so I will come up with my strategy of what that should look like and do that in ways, the quickest way to get it done, or the way that will be most visibly successful. Now, we have to have integrity in how we do the work of God according to the values of the gospel, the humility and grace and patience, and treating people not as a means to an end. That's a great tragedy when leaders do that, and it happens frequently, where a leader has a vision, which they believe has come from God. Whether it has or not is a different question. But even if it has, that vision can begin to use people as a means towards the end of the vision. But people are never simply a means to an end. Yes, it is through people that God accomplishes his work. So people in that sense are a means to an end, but they are also an end in themselves. They are the end of God's love and of God's desire to see them developed in Christ-likeness. Solomon sadly here, I think, uses Israelite people as a means to an end. And this is a massive project that may have involved something like a seventh of the people of Israel, the numbers of people involved. If you compare that with David's census in 2 Samuel 24:9, where there were 800,000 and then another 500,000, and then the figures of people involved here are roughly a seventh of that total number. So again, we see here this strange mixture in Solomon, don't we, of wisdom that is given from God, ability to administer, but perhaps a way of using that that is becoming oppressive and using people wrongly. But the challenge is, again, for us, how do we treat people? We cannot see the vision, even if it's God-given, as being something that is more important than the people who God is calling to fulfill that vision. We must nurture them, care for them, develop them. If we're Christian leaders, develop them in their walk with God and their likeness to Christ. Equip them for the service that God has given them to do. Give them a vision of God and his glory, yes, but trust God to lead their response to that in response to his grace rather than our oppressive leadership. Building a temple for God was God's purpose, a glorious thing. But Solomon's means of doing it were less glorious. Mixture of wisdom from God and human wisdom. We need to make sure we do everything according to God's wisdom.